First of all, we'd like to dedicate this show this evening to someone who died last week, Yaakov Ben Chaima Cohen. We know that it's a very special thing for the neshama if you dedicate Torah to them. She ben ilu to the neshama. We just came out now of the 3 weeks of what the mystics call the 3 weeks of the hidden, the 3 weeks of the hidden world. And we're now moving into what they call the 7 weeks of the revealed world. Or put another way, 3 weeks of very difficult times. So it's called the Shlesha de Puranusa. That means 3 weeks where we have a lot of concentration of tragedies in Jewish history. It's a time when we hold our breath. Now we breathe a little bit easier as we move into 7 weeks that are a time that end with Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, move through Elul, which is a time of building spiritually. The mystics say it's as if the first three are sort of like a pregnancy, or they are in the hidden dimension where you don't see what's being thought. It's like in the dimension of thought, let's say. And then you have the 7 weeks where the thought becomes manifest and you see it. Now, there's a mystical way. Monday night we're supposed to talk about mysticism. This idea can be looked at. There's a specific application of this idea, which is a very wonderful thing to understand. You can understand the first three as being what they call male. What's called Zachar, male. And the seven you can understand as being female. It means the male dimension is always the spark in the hidden world, and then the female is always the manifestation. It's where that spark comes out and you see it manifest or built in the world. Like the male contribution to a child is always hidden, you don't see that. But it's the woman who gives the manifest dimension. That means what she builds actually comes out, you see that in the world. The mystics say that that's the way it works emotionally, that's the way it works spiritually, it works physically that way. It has to be that way. Let's try and understand an idea that goes along this pathway that's mystically based, but you see has tremendous practical application. We'll choose this idea because the work that we have to do over the next few weeks until Rosh Hashanah is a work of perfection. That means we set aside 3 weeks for mourning, where we went through a consciousness of the tragedies that have happened to us, and we become aware of our loneliness, especially this generation. And then we have 7 weeks set aside where we're supposed to build. So we don't look back anymore towards the tragedies. We look ahead and we try and build ourselves. And in order to build, we need to understand this idea very deeply. And it's an idea that the mystics talk about, which is a duality in the mind. It means that there's a male dimension in the mind and there's a female dimension in the mind. And the way these two fit together, if a person can get the marriage between these two parts correct, then a person could gain a tremendous depth of self-control or thought control. And then a person could be in control in general and build correctly. And that's what they call Sechel and Dimyon. That means intellect and imagination, roughly translated. There's a male dimension that's called Sechel. That means it's a dimension of what's called, in English, probably intellect. Then there's a dimension that they call imagination. Again, the English words have connotations which are so badly beaten into insensitivity that actually we can't hear the Torah ideas there at all. But let's try and use the word Sechel and Dimyon, and we'll try and feel out how this works. Now, that's a very, very deep subject, and again, the problem that we're faced with is that anything in the mystical world actually can't be expressed in words, so we're actually struggling with the impossible. All we can do is try and more or less say the words, and actually what will happen is only somebody who really understands anyway will understand, and somebody who doesn't understand actually won't understand. That's the way it is with the mystical language. But the idea of doing it is because the one who does understand could get a new depth. And the mystics say that the one who doesn't understand, he could maybe just be bumped over the edge until he falls in and realizes that he actually did know it, just wasn't conscious of the fact. But actually to explain it to somebody who doesn't have the sensitivity, so that's possibly, might even be impossible. The truth is that actually everybody does know this idea, and the whole mystical system is just a description of reality. It's not an attempt to prove something, it's just an attempt to describe reality so accurately that you click into realizing that you actually understand it. And then you could use it to understand a new depth in it or a new application, and you could start to work with it. But the words themselves don't convey the idea. That's always the problem that we face with. The words are only... It's like you're trying to put in words what you actually feel for someone. If you have a deep, intense and intimate relationship with someone, then the words are actually an embarrassment. Because to put into finite words what some real human experience is impossible. And especially when it's a mystical dimension, because that's a level that the mystics call knowledge, which means inner knowledge or intimate knowledge or real knowledge, things that you know because you know them. They can't be articulated in words, as we've often discussed before. But let's try and talk around it a little bit until we begin to maybe fill out the picture a bit more clearly. Now, to understand this idea, we'll have to take a journey through a number of areas. The first thing is we'll have to understand... You don't have a seat? Are they bringing you? Their seats here, please. I get embarrassed if you stand. Maybe people can move forward so that lady can sit down. Area that we studied together before, let's try and revise our knowledge of it, and let's try and pick out the elements that we're going to need for this discussion. Now you'll see a wonderful description of the spiritual world opening up here. The mystics say that this particular idea, on which this theme is based, is something that everything in the universe is based on. It's not just a nice detail, that's a rock bottom fundamental on which everything in the spiritual world and therefore the real world is based. As we've discussed many times before, anything in the spiritual world is just the genes of the physical. Which means that if you wish to understand something physical, then you have to know how the spiritual genes work. And of course, the only way you can do that is by studying the physical. You can't see the genes, but you can see what they express. Right? Or you can put another way, if you're not a biologist, if you look at the machine, you can figure out what the plan must have looked like, and the design, and what the purpose was, and the whole pathway through the machine, or the production process. And therefore what we do is we study the thing, and then we figure out what the plan must have been. Again, this takes for granted we're not going back that far. We're still taking for granted that we sharing this discussion this evening are all people who understand that a human being is put together purposefully. If you think you're an accidental gorilla, so then this discussion is not going to make any sense at all. But let's take that for granted for now. Other occasions we've tried to prove that element, but let's start from there. And therefore when you look at a purposeful structure, what you try and do is trace back the design that went into building this thing. You understand that everything's there for a function, for a purpose, and therefore you trace it back. And therefore, if we find that in the mind we have faculties, one of them is called intellect, or seichel, let's call it, which is the raw control pathway in the mind. And then there's a faculty called imagination, which is the faculty of images, pictures. So then we understand that must be a very fundamental thing, because everything we do, everything we think, is a duality. It's a unifying marriage between those two things. So let's do it as follows. Let's first of all study briefly what is the concept of male and female. Let's try and extract some basic fundamentals about what it means male and what means female. Then let's try and apply it into these two levels of the mind. It's a very beautiful way that we can start this transition from the 3 into the 7 would be the transition from male to female. It's a very difficult area to talk about because of its intimacy, but let's try and fill it out in the abstract world as best we can. So the whole discussion rests on the following idea. The mystics say in many, many different ways that if you define male and female accurately, you'll understand the whole world. Because the mystical language, the expression is, that nothing in the world can exist unless it has a mother and a father. In other words, there must be a male dimension, and there must be a female dimension, whatever those two things mean, in order to create anything real in the world. Let's start with that. So what we understand by the concept male, again we have to get out of our patterns of thinking about what's a man and what's a woman. It so happens that most men manifest these male qualities, and most women still do manifest these female qualities, even in this mixed up situation, generation. But nevertheless, you can still trace these values in most people in the West. But certainly the idea is clear. Actually, it's much more complex because every man has certain female characteristics and women have both as well, and any relationship is a very complex enmeshing of poles, of spectra on different levels. But let's first of all just get the classical idea clear before we try and look at its complicated application. So the idea that's called male, the mystics describe something like this. It's the quality in the spiritual world of putting in a spark of something new. In the mystical language, it's called the Yesh Me'ayin. We've discussed this many times together. That's as close as you can get to a definition. That means it's the mystical ability to generate something that wasn't there before, to translate something, to distill out of a world that wasn't manifest, a spark that becomes manifest. The only way to really understand this is to see it again in its physical manifestation. If we understand how the body works, then we can use that automatic switch that we have to abstract it into what it means in the real world. And the mystics say that if you look at the way the body works, you'll see that the male and female functions are exactly opposite. Not just accidental, but every single detail of the way the male functions in the creation of a third living being is exactly opposite to the way the female functions. Let's understand. The way the male functions is that when a seed is produced that will become the next, let's say the child, if you look at a relationship between humans, then the way the seed is produced is a distillation of the entirety of what the father is. It contains everything that's needed to reproduce. That means it's exactly what he is, including the ability to do the same thing again. And it's transmitted, all of the only crystallization or concretization that it gets is just enough to make it real. That, if you like, is the female side of being male. But let's ignore that for now. The male part of being male is to take something that wasn't there before and just make something that could start something. But as soon as it's at that phase, he's finished. The male cannot continue beyond the stage where something new is generated. He cannot make it real or alive in the world. The beauty of being male, the power of being a male, the mystics say, is the ability to generate something that wasn't there before. But the problem, the curse of being male, is that without a woman to give it form and shape and life, so then it just dies. Try and understand, this is the Jewish prohibition of the wastage of male seed. It's not a superstition. The concept is that if a male takes his life energy, his ability to actually produce a life in the world, and that's blasted out into waste without being given loyally into the place, which is the loyal woman who has to give expression to everything that the two of them are, so then that's a waste of life energy. And it builds tremendous negative forces in the world. We'll try and study them as well. The mystics call them shaydim. They are creatures that are halfway between angels and people, because they have some qualities of the spiritual beings and they have some qualities of the physical beings. Very remarkable and dangerous area. Try and explain it as well. But let's build up slowly. So we have here this quality that's called male. It means taking something from a previous stage, translating it into the next stage, but it's only the point of translation. That's it. It's only the point of transition or translation from another world into, from one world into another world. That's all. As soon as the translation is being done, so then the male disappears. If he would continue any further, that would be called female. The female, what's called nekeva in Hebrew, nekeva means female, that's the dimension that takes the spark that the male generates, and she builds it into something real. She doesn't generate the spark. Actually, the female also generates her own seed, and that's the male part of being female. But again, let's just keep it straightforward. Are you with me? Cool. Surprising. Okay, so again, so the female dimension is exactly opposite. What a woman does, or what the female does in the mystical world, she picks up the spark that the male generates in the world. The difference is that the male generates the spark outside of himself. Right? And the woman only can build that spark inside, within herself. That's a whole discussion about the hiddenness of woman, how she hides what she is, and how brocha and expansion can only come in the hidden dimension, which we've discussed before also. But what she does with that seed, with that spark, is exactly the opposite of what the male does. What the male does is that he gives it enough concrete reality only just to be here, and then he can't relate to it anymore. What the woman does is she takes it and builds it into its totality. The mystics say that, if you like, the male dimension is as limited as it could be in time and space. In other words, he's as close to the spiritual world as possible. He's as close to the spiritual world as possible. It means that as soon as it condenses into physical reality, so then it's not male anymore, and that's why the male doesn't relate anymore to that process. But the female dimension is as close to this world as possible, not the spiritual world. She's as close to the practical, tangible, real world as possible. And therefore she takes that thing that's just become something that's in her dimension, and then she builds it into something that's very real in this world. And that's why the male qualities are always as small as possible and as brief as possible. Maleness means a spark that lasts a very brief instant of time, its generation, and it's very, very small, microscopically small. But the female dimension takes a long time and it takes large space. That means she builds that spark into what it's going to be, but exactly with the opposite quality. And of course, that's why a woman's strength spiritually is the quality of loyalty. It's the ability to put everything into one relationship. and to make it richer and to consolidate and make it more beautiful and more deep, whereas the male's problem is always that he needs a new spark of excitement someplace because he needs to generate a new electricity all the time, as we discussed when we discussed marriage before. And therefore, the woman's man. And therefore, you'll see that there are a number of differences that exist between them. The male seed, the male generation, again, is something that involves only what they call ecstasy. Its pain is a totally different pain. The male pain is the pain of the pain of the fact that the sharper the pleasure, the more the thrill of generation, the more the thrill of a new idea, or whatever a male generates, the sharper is the awareness that as you catch it, it's over. That's what's called the male pain. And it's hard to explain these things, to be too explicit. The female pain is the pain of having to build constantly. That means her work is that she has to limit more and more and more. Instead of being a new energy all the time, she has to define and make finite just one. The mystics put it something like this. They say that when a male contributes a seed, the excitement of that in the spiritual world is that the seed could be anybody. That means the child that could be born out of this coding could be anybody. Depends on how it's built, it could be anyone. It's tremendous multi-potential energy. It's also the reason why there are many seeds on the male side. Whereas on the female side, there's only just one that has to be used. It's no accident at all. It's also why the male generates seeds in an infinite way, and the female very, very finitely generates seeds throughout nature. It's no accident, these things. If you think that these things bumped into each other over a few million years of accidents, so then you don't know how to look at this clearly. That's how this generation thinks about these things, between one sleep and the next. So they don't pick up the thread or the pattern that unifies things. But it's obvious, it's just a description of reality. It's not an attempt to prove anything, just a description of the way things are, which is all that the mystical system is. After she's picked up that seed and defines it, she has to do what's called the curse of being a woman. The blessing of being a woman is that she can build something that wasn't there before. When a woman's finished with a spark, that would have died if she hadn't been there, within seconds or minutes or hours it would have died. If she hadn't been there, it would have died. Now that she's there, what happens is you have a real human being. You have a person. The beauty and the blessing of being a woman is that she gives something into the world that's alive and self-contained, and that's here. But the curse of being a woman is that she has to limit it to just one thing. Because in a finite world, you cannot have multiple expressions of the same thing. You can only have one thing. If you like, let's lift it a little bit into the mind. Let's just see if we're clear on the details of the definition. Okay? Again, the male is a transition from nothing to something. The woman is the picking up of the just something and making it something finite and real. In Hebrew, you see this amazingly. The word zachar in Hebrew, the word zachar, which means male. You know, in Hebrew, in the mystical system, we always understand that the words actually tell you what they mean. Not like in other languages. Other languages, while they're all derived from Hebrew, we have a mystical tradition that all languages are split from the Hebrew root. But nevertheless, they've become so manipulated and changed, transmuted with time, that it's not always easy to recognize the root. But in Hebrew, in Torah, the word actually means the thing in every possible way, in the shape of the letters, in the numerology of the letters, in every possible way. And if you examine this concept, you'll see it's no different. The word zachar in Hebrew, which means male, has a number of amazing meanings. One of them is memory, means to remember. Zachar means to remember. So the mystics say it's because maleness is a translation from one dimension to the next. That's what memory is. The only thing you have of the past, the only thing that translates you from yesterday to today is your memory. Actually, nothing else is the same. It's the consciousness that you bear with you from even the cells of your body aren't the same after a few days. The water molecules in your body and the cells of your body constantly transmuting themselves in equilibrium with the environment. Actually, physically, you aren't the same person you were a week ago at all, if you think about it. Physically is where you literally transmute all the time. Of course, we're used to thinking exactly the opposite. We think that your mind comes and goes. You know, it's lucky if you have any. But physically, we think that we're here to stay. But of course, it's not that way at all. The water cycle in your body, actually, you are recycled. You are recycled rain of 1,000 years ago. You are recycled plasma of the greats who lived 1,000 years ago. That's really what you are. And it only lasts for seconds before it's on its way out again. That's what you are physically. The only thing that you're really constant from yesterday today is the consciousness that you carry with you, which is called the memory of yesterday. That's called zeicher. Also, the Hebrew word zikaron, which means a memory, adds up to the same numerical word number as zera, which means a seed. Which means that a seed, which is the ultimate expression of maleness, is actually a memory. That's what a seed is. A seed is a closed bundle of memory. The mystics say, if you look at the seed of a tree, it doesn't look like a little tree. If you cut open a seed, a child might think that if you cut open a seed of a tree, you'll find a little tree. But you don't. All you find is the intangible memory, the abstraction of what there was before. But that memory is so potent that given the right woman, in the case of a seed, given the earth into which it will fall and disintegrate and sprout, so then what will happen is the memory will be activated and you'll have exactly what was there before, including the ability to do the same thing again. That means it's the memory of all previous generations and it carries within it the potency of all future generations. When you go home, you jump up and down with excitement, right? It's wonderful to understand these things. After you're brought up in a culture that tells you that this is all accident. I'm not offended if you don't jump up and down. Okay, so that's the idea of maleness and a seed. The female dimension is exactly the opposite. That is taking the memory and translating it into literal reality, into physical reality. And of course the curse on the female side is the limitation. The mystics say if you want to put it into the... And of course the word female, I mean we don't... I presume that you're racing ahead of me, as usual. The word female in Hebrew, the word nekeva in Hebrew, actually has three meanings, which all go around this idea. It means female, it means a curse, Some trouble with the feminists. And it means to limit or make finite. Like it says, Nokfa alai schocha betana, fix your wages and I'll pay you. What's the connection between fixing and a curse? So the idea is obvious after what we explained. Is that the idea of a curse is that you don't have more than what you had before. The Jewish idea of blessing, the Torah idea of a bracha, is that what you see is only just the tip of an iceberg or the tip of a reality that's hidden. And it's constantly expressing itself as more. It's always more and more and more. That's why the word Adam, which means a man in Hebrew, if you rearrange the letters, it spells Moed, which means very. Which means more. It means much. Because a human being is not something that is. It's something that is always becoming more. But the female dimension is something that doesn't allow it to become more. It makes it exactly what it is. And that, in a sense, that freezing, but of course the opposite side of the coin is the blessing. The blessing is that you have something real. The mystics say, if you want to look at it in the mind, let's step up now from the body into the mind. We've discussed already now, let's understand what we've done. We've discussed now the basic definition in the abstract mystical world of what's called male and female. But without that, we can't go anyplace else. And then you can check it out again. It's not... We haven't proven anything, we're just trying to describe. You'll see that those are the qualities. Let's try and lift it up into the level of the mind and see how it functions at the level of the mind. What are the qualities that are required? We're going to need all the elements of definition that we've said up to now. When you lift it up into the level of the mind, we'll need a few extra details to know. And some of them are as follows. The male dimension, the mystics say, you have to hear well now, the male dimension is completely powerless, as I understand now. The male dimension, the mystics call the right-hand side. But it's the left-hand side that's called Gvura. It means the side where the power is. The right-hand side is the side of Chesed. It means it gives. It gives freely, but without energy. The left-hand side limits, but with energy. A way to illustrate this possibly would be that, let's say, the mystics would say that when you have an idea, that's called male. When you do the idea in the world, that's called female. Exactly the same thing. Of course, exactly as we said before, what's done in the world reflects what was thought. If somebody builds something that he planned to build, then when you see the building, you can understand exactly how he planned it. So it's a revelation of what the hidden world was, just like a woman reveals what the seed was of the male. When it's given from male to female or generated by the male, you don't see anything. When the woman expresses it in the world, then you can see the qualities that came from the male and how the woman expressed them. So when somebody plans a building, when an architect gets an inspiration, what happens is he gets a flash of energy. And then what happens is when he builds it, you see it. But of course the flash of inspiration doesn't have any power. It's the most ethereal wisp of energy in the world. You can't even measure the activity of the brain that's involved in an idea. But when expressed in the world, it takes tremendous power. It may take enormous machines to do. But tremendous energy is needed in order to make a thing finite and concrete. And we'll see that the mystics say that men have no power, spiritually. Men are just able to do the briefest contribution to anything and then they finish, they're out of it physically, they're bored, emotionally. Whereas woman has the ability to put the energy in and the constancy and the loyalty and what it needs, what's taken, what's needed to build something that's finite and real. Again, women usually understand these things much better than men do. There's no reason that men shouldn't understand. Now, let's try and understand this. So if we take the physical world and translate it up into the world of the mind, so we see the following idea, that the idea is called male and the execution is called female. But the mystics say you can do one more thing with that. You can go up entirely into the mind and you can see that there are two dimensions in the mind, one called male and one called female. That's what we're supposed to be studying this evening. The higher level, again, it's not in value sense, it's only that the higher level is considered to be the one that gives, and the earth is considered to be the level into which it falls and gives back and produces. So the higher level is called seichel, intellect, and the lower level is called dimyon, imagination. The male level is called what's called seichel, and the female level of the mind is called dimyon, which we call imagination in English. Try and understand it, study it. You'll see that what we also need to know, apart from where the energy is, where the plan dimension is and where the energy is, two opposite sides of the spectrum, we also need to know that each one needs to be aware of the job that it has to do in order not to fall into the trap of the curse that's inherent in its own nature. Again, the problem with the male is that if he puts his energy out without making it tangible enough for a woman to receive, so then that's called tremendous curse. The mystics say that the curse of that is a man who's not loyal. That means a man who needs the experience of a new woman, in whatever sense it is, literal, physical, emotional, spiritual, that disloyalty is what blasts out creative energy into so many places that actually none of it gets picked up and built and created. A man has to learn enough female discipline in order to concretize what he is in his inspirational level so that it has some tangible reality in the world, so he can give it to a woman to do the job with. But a woman has to learn not to concretize and free so much that she kills. The Bala Musa, who have a mystical bent, they sometimes say that in marriage you'll see a tension with the male personality. It isn't always the man, by the way, but the male personality is the one who always needs a new experience, and he often wants to break out of the relationship, or he wants to express himself in a new way. And the one who manifests a female personality gets anxious about that and tries to lock in and freeze. And the more she tries to limit and freeze, or to have or to hold, so then the male-oriented personality tries to break out more. And then you have a vicious cycle that says, oh, many tensions in marriage, you see that way. So a woman has to learn, a female has to learn, that in order to make a thing real, she has to freeze the thing, she has to give it enough physical reality, but just to keep it alive. She must take what they call a spark and keep it alive as a spark. Not take a spark and concretize it into something frozen. She must keep the spark and fan it into a flame. That means she has to do an amazing job. She has to take this thing that's a small fire, and she has to make it bigger and bigger and bigger, but keep it alive as a fire. That means she has to keep its male dimension burning. She has to keep its energetic, its speck of energy that it had before, its ability to bring something new into the world. She has to give it just enough tangible reality so it can bring something new in again and again and again. And eventually when she has to do that with pain, she has to tear herself away from it, which is painful, dangerous. She has to do that also. And that's how the whole of a woman's work is like that. All that takes tremendous maturity, tremendous wisdom, says in the mystical sources, that a woman needs in order to be able to give this into the world. Now, if we apply that to the mind, to this dimension of of seichel and dimyon, so we'll see the following idea. You'll see that, let's try and understand like this. Let's look at it generally first, and we'll try and focus in specifically. The dimension that we call the creative dimension, or the something from nothing dimension, that's the ethereal dimension in the mind that doesn't have any energy. It's called the pathway of logic. We call it seichel. It means that the control dimension is like the computer's program, let's say. It's like the program of the computer. The dimyon, the imagination, the imaginary dimension of the mind, that isn't a program. That is the images or the factors or the numbers that the computer needs. Again, when you have a program in a computer, the program can't do anything. You have to put in the facts. You have to put in the variables. The tangible elements which are limited to this particular problem or situation. That's called dimyon. It's the tangible images that you have in your mind. The intellectual side of your mind is the side that plans it and plans it from beginning to end before you even begin. But doesn't have any energy. The energy comes from the power of the lower levels, the emotional level, the physical level, that gives you the tangible memories, factors, people, the finite and physical aspects of what you're dealing with, and the one manipulates the other. The intellect uses the images or the givens or the numbers or the pictures or whatever it is, the factors, the variables, the real things, and it moves them through time and space so that you have something working in the end. Let's try and take a step back and understand this a bit better. Let's look at it from the letters again. So in the mystical writings, it says that you can see this idea, like all mystical ideas, you can see it from the Aleph Beis. Just from the letters Aleph Beis Gimel, just look at the Hebrew alphabet, and you can see all these ideas. One of the most exciting things to understand, one of the beautiful things in the mystical world. They say that the closer you get to the beginning, the more the male quality. The closer you get to the end, the more the female quality. But actually, just like we said before, the male and female dimensions always work in opposite. They always work opposite to each other. Where male and female meet is an amazing place where the most female of the male meets the most male of the female. Incredible place where the energy is generated. Again, it's hard to talk about too. And of course, that's why people still have a sensitivity that there's a certain area of a relationship. Well, that's hard to speak about here. But you can actually feel that that's where the electricity is generated. So they look at it in the other place, they say the following thing. If you want to trace it, I mean, it's so clear. The way you trace it in other places, you would understand something like this. The Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is purely male. That's entirely a male letter. Well, how do you see it? It has no expression. You can't say it. In other words, the Aleph is just where nothing becomes something. It is the beginning of the Aleph base, but it has no sound. It's only silent letter. And Ayin is not silent in Hebrew. The Aleph is a silent letter. Because it's the transition from nothing to something, but it hasn't yet entered the world fully. And of course, that's why the word Aleph, the letter Aleph, actually is a word in Hebrew. And it means to raise to a spiritual level. Aleph in Hebrew means to teach or to train or to lift up to a higher level. And Aleph means 1,000, which is the highest number on the decimal system. And Aluf is the highest rank. All the Aleph roots in Hebrew always mean to lift up, right, into a higher world. Of course, in modern Hebrew, these things have been perverted. They've taken these most ethereal and fine spiritual ideas and given them the most, battered them into the exact opposite. That's a reliable rule. In modern Hebrew, La'alef means to train dogs. That's what it means. That's exactly what it means. La'alef means to train in a rote sense that an animal gets used to something. That's exactly what it means. But that's not what it means mystically. You shouldn't go by modern Hebrew. That's used in the wrong sense. In the Torah, that's what aleph means. So it means the highest, it means an elevation. And of course, that's why it can't be said in the world. And that's why the aleph actually is made up of three letters. If you look at an aleph in Hebrew, it's spelled by two yuds and a vav. That's how an aleph is. Two yuds. The higher yud, the yud from the higher world, the 10 mystical spheres that come down from the transcendent world. The 10, that means the male, the 10 male elements of creativity. The 10 female elements of creativity as they wait to be expressed. And the line, the straight line that joins them, which is called a vav. Vav in Hebrew means a hook. The letter actually means a connector. Actually means a connector. And of course the total of them is 26, which is Hashem's name. Hashem's name of creativity, the name that begins the creation of the world, that adds up to 26, which is exactly what an aleph is. So it expresses the fact that it's the ultimate male dimension, and of course that's why we always refer to Hashem in the male. It's not because we don't have a feminist outlook on the world, it's because it's the dimension of a spark that's put in. The world is always called female because that's where the birth takes place, that's where reality concretizes. That's aleph. The taf at the end of the aleph base is the most female. The mystics say that the aleph is the place where the idea happens, the taf is when the idea is completed. And if you go from aleph to taf, what happens is you see first an idea. The mystics describe it through all the pathways, although we don't have time to go into it now, but all the mystical pathways of ideation. The way you think goes through mystical stages. First there's the something from nothing flash of an inspiration that you don't know where it came from. That's called aleph. When you get a new idea, you don't know where it came from. Where do you get a new idea from? You get it from the mystical transcendent world. Where does a new idea come in from? You can't go up and get a new idea. When you have to solve a problem, a fantastic area to think about, and you can actually experience it. When you have to solve a problem, where do you go for the answer? Now, people have got this strange infantile idea that you think about the problem and you think about the answer. You think about it, you work it out. But of course you can't do that. What happens, let's think about it carefully. When you have a problem and you have to work it out, what do? You get the variables clear in your mind and you think about it. You don't think about the answer. How can you think about the answer? You don't have the answer. You think about the problem. And you think about it so much that when you stop thinking about it, suddenly the answer comes in. Actually, the mystics say that concentration is not thinking about the thing, it's clearing the mind of noise, that's all. It's just clearing an empty space. It's going up to the top of your consciousness and clearing out the interference. When you clear out a translucent or transparent area, then the idea drops in. By the way, that's why in Yiddish, an idea is called an Einfall. It means it falls in. Well, that's exactly what it does. And you can actually feel that. The most dramatic time when that happens is when you weren't expecting it. When you so clear the mind of the problem that it falls. Usually when you wake up. Usually you'll study and it's amazing, you have nodding heads from this side, understand, the title. Huh? But even a man can understand, say, even men can understand, that what often happens is when you work on a problem, let's say you spend an afternoon or an evening on a very difficult and complex problem, So you can work on it, and sometimes you even have the answer. Sometimes you look at a textbook or some piece of Gemara. So you study the thing, and you study all the variables until it's buzzing, until you know it absolutely forwards and backwards and sideways, but you don't understand what it means. Or it's a problem, and you work on it, and the answer is just on the tip of your tongue, and you can almost see, but you just... So what happens? You eventually fall asleep exhausted because you can't solve it. And as you wake up, suddenly you understand. And then, of course, you've got the goal to say, I worked it out. Because he didn't work out anything. You just left enough empty space, what the mystics call, you left a transparent area so clear that you were able to generate it. But you always have to be aware that it's given as a gift. No new idea is generated. Every real spark of creativity is definitely a gift. And anybody who's halfway sensitive knows they can feel that. You suddenly hit by an inspiration, and it's always a male experience. It's an ecstatic experience, and it only lasts an instant. As soon as it's there, it's gone. That's the characteristic of an idea. As it flashes, women can feel this also, but that's the male pole of thought. As it flashes into the mind, what happens is it lights up the mind, and then in that instant, you know that you understand the whole situation and all the factors, even though there isn't time to think about them, but you know that it's all there, and in the next instant, you start to think about the details, and it all falls into place, and the happiness is gone. Another happiness takes over, which is the happiness of actually working it out. But the ecstasy of having... And in that instant, you have a mystical experience. It's the highest and closest you can get to a true mystical experience. Because what happens is, in an instant, you realize that the whole thing is there. Even though there's no finite time to work it all out. But you're already aware that it's all there, and that's the happiness. Again, you can't talk about these things. It just spoils them. But anybody who knows how he functions, or who's ever had an idea, knows that that's the way it goes. And then what happens is it descends from that male level into a more female level. The more female level is where the idea starts to take shape. And it starts to have its details. And then, of course, that level becomes male with regard to the next level down and starts to become more tangible until it's all planned out in detail. Then it becomes even more female and is put onto a drawing board. So it's already tangible in the world, but it's not the building yet. And then the design is taken out to the building site and the building begins. And that becomes, until finally, the final structure looks like exactly like the first thing. When the architect gets that idea, the whole thing is there in an instant. And then he starts breaking it down into detail, and then they build it, and the final result is the first in thought. The final result is the first, and the mystics say it's an incredible idea. If you think about it, the way it goes always is that the energy is in the second half where it's actually built, and they go in opposite dimensions. The way the mystics put it is something like this. The male experience is always an experience of totality. In the first instant, it generated everything. Then it starts to break down into details. And the final stage of the male set of processes is that the details are the most detailed. And the female always starts by building details until the totality is finished. If you wonder, if it's not clear, I'll give you a crude example. When an architect sets out to build a building, what happens is the first thing that hits him is the totality of the idea. It's an ecstatic experience, he has the whole thing. Then he starts to break it down into how many floors, how many rooms, how many walls, and finally he thinks about each brick and each door handle. But when the woman's dimension begins exactly the opposite, they start with each brick and each door handle and each room, and then you have the building. It's exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. Always like that. And the final result when the woman's finished is what was planned originally in the spark of energy that contained everything in the mystical world. Of course it carries, this idea goes further. If you think about where they meet, again it's hard to talk about it in detail, but if you think about where they meet, where do they meet? Let's take an example like this. Where does the architect's plan meet the builder's building? Again, carefully. You know, there are 11 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Let's try and explain. There are 22 letters in the alphabet, 11 male, 11 female. So the mystics say that the first 11 are male letters, and the second 11 are female letters. And of course, there are many ways you can see this. The first of the male letters is an aleph. The first of the female letters is a lamed. Put them together, you get Hashem's name that creates the world. The first male creative energy, the first female creative energy, you have the force that actually creates the world. Kael, Hashem's name. The name of Chesed, which actually creates the world. There are many, many ways you see this. I'll give you another example. If you add one more dimension to the female side, you get the word mother. You get Aim, Aleph and Mem. And so it goes. If you take the first two male letters, you get Av, father. Take Aleph base. Don't you jump up and down. You get Aleph base, the first two letters of the alphabet, the first two male dimensions. The Aleph is too ethereal to be in the world. As soon as you put a base, which is just a little touch of being female, you get the word Av, which is a father. If you take the next of the female letters, you get the word Even, if you add them together, which means a stone. The mystics say that a stone is the building blocks of reality. And the word is an enmeshing of Av and Ben, the word for father and son. And the word Even is female, means mother. Right? Even Eben Shisia, the stone from which the world is formed, we always refer to it in the feminine, even though it's a mixing of the words father and son. So you understand that? So now, if we say like this, so now, if you take the male letters as they come down towards the detail and the female letters as they build up from the detail, so where do they meet? What is the element at which they meet? That point where the 11 male letters meet the 11 female. The mystics have a wonderful insight. They say that if you understand when an idea becomes something that's built, if, for example, when an architect builds, so the architect's plan, his thought processes and the whole plan is the male side. The builder, building the building, is the female side. Where do they meet? What's that element that joins the plan dimension to the building dimension and is neither? Think about it. What is that element in the world? There's a special creation in the world. There's a special object, a special creation in the world. That's not part of the plan and it's not part of the building. The tools. The tools, no? The tools are what manipulate. They're not part of the plan and they're not part of the result. They are the things that connect the plan. And the middle four letters in the Hebrew alphabet spell Kalim, tools. The last two malefits. There are many ways you see it, but that's the pattern. So you have, I'll give you a crude example that often makes a lot of sense to us, where you can feel this out. Unfortunately, the only way to discuss the subject is to go around the examples until it actually comes home. There's no succinct description, the definition of these things. It's just an exploring of the idea until you actually feel that that's the way you think. And then you can start to work with it once it's become clear. I'll give you a crude example that's very meaningful to most of us. My Rebbe once put it this way, very beautiful, very clear. He said that, you'll see that there are two kinds of personality. There's a male type personality and a female type personality in many things. The male type personality is an aleph to tough personality. That means the quality of the aleph is that it contains everything. So the real male personality is the personality in this regard, at least in this regard, where the way he approaches a job is that he has a total definition of plan from beginning to end, all in the first instant. And he lives in the dimension of plan. But the active part of the female is living in the building. What would be an example? Give you an example. Simple example. Students studying for an exam. When people study for an exam, many people have had that experience. You have here, there's a male way of approaching it and a female. Very clear. So the Bala Musa, they put it something like this. They say that the way the male personality approaches a system like that, an exam, he makes a timetable. That's what he does. He sits down and makes a timetable. It's a masterpiece, the timetable. It has every subject and every page of every textbook indicated in a different colour. It's all ruled with a ruler. It's all straight. It has every hour of every day taken care of from now until the exam. And he works on it for days. And then it gets, and then it gets pinned up on the wall. And then he studies it some more. But he never opens the book. Right? Because the male personality always feels that he's in control in the overall. But when he starts to work on the material, so then he says to himself, what the chances they'll ask me this page? That's always, as we said before, the expression of the male personality. Doesn't want to bring it down into the practical, tangible reality. The female personality approaches an exam like a sits down, opens a book and starts studying. That's the female personality. Of course, you realize there's a big broch and a big klala on each. In the male dimension, you have a beauty, is that there's a tremendous plan. The klala is that never gets anything done. The beauty in the female dimension is that the work starts, the work proceeds, but it may be completely haphazard and not well planned. That's the problem. By the way, this is the reason why men, unless you see this very strongly in Western society, very strong distinction, that's why men are addicted to newspapers. Right? That's why men need to read newspapers. Because there are men, by the way, it's a very uncommon for it to be a woman's problem. Very uncommon that a woman's addicted every day to reading the newspaper. But many, many, many men in Western culture can't survive the day unless they read it. What happens is, if he hasn't read the newspaper, he feels like the world is, you know, that once it's... That comes from the male concept. Once he's read the newspaper, then he's in control. The world is running. Right? I knew you'd enjoy the practical. A man feels that when he knows what's happening in southern Mongolia and northern China, so then, like, he's got the world under control, his forces are operating, the world is functioning the way it should be, and, like, he can relax now. But until he knows what's happening... Come on, no? Huh? But feels very uneasy until that time. It's a global type of overview that he's addicted to. That is the pure element of control, but it doesn't have any tangible reality. That's purely male. No energy, and it's pure plan. It's pure overview. The female dimension is called imagination, dimion. Dimion means that it doesn't have any plan, doesn't have any overview, but it has all the energy and all the tangible material. In your experience, it is your memories, that means your tangible images, very tangible, including smells and reliving the emotions that go with it. And it's all the picturing of words that you do. Right? Most of us, the way most of us live, most people aren't able to get up into pure seichel at all. The effort of being, of transcendence, of meditation, is to try and get up into the world of seichel, where dimyon puts up only enough tangible reality to keep the program running, but never runs away with you. Most people manage only to get basically into the area of dimyon. For example, the way most people think is by a dialogue. The way most of us think is by very, very tangible. We say something, then we run around and listen to how it sounds, then we answer back, and then we run around again. That is how most people think, actually. We don't think about a thing as it is. We think about what the words of the thing say. We're unable to get beyond the dimyon dimension. It takes tremendous self-control for us to push the thought process from one step to the next in a purely logical fashion, where the only images or emotional elements are exactly what are needed to go from step one to step two. There's a reason for this. Try to understand. The mystics say the reason is as follows. A very, very important idea to understand. The reason is as follows. The dimension that's called male, the seichel, the intellect dimension, is a very, it's perfectly logical, perfectly organized, but has no energy at all. It only functions with an input of energy that's given to it by a woman. The female dimension has tremendous energy, but no control. So what happens is this. This is the easy way to feel it. I mean, if you want to feel it tangibly, it's like this. When you put no energy in to the thought process, what happens is only the dimyon dimension works, because it has its own energy. But the cycle dimension, when you sit back in an easy chair and close your eyes and relax, cycle doesn't work. You do not proceed from one logical step to the next in an inexorable chain of logic. That's not the way it works. What happens is your imagination starts flashing you from one place to the next. The only way cycle works is when you make a conscious self-control effort to take step one to step two to the next step to the next step. But only with an input of energy, and it's only too easy to lose it. Because the power dimension of dimyon is so powerful, and it's so illogical, that what it does is it breaks... Understand. This is, let's describe, instead of trying to define it, let's just describe it much easier. You sit down to think of a problem, okay? You have to go from step one to step two to step three. You've got to solve the problem. The process is needed logic. And the logic operates on the givens. It's this person and that person and this place and that place and this factor and that problem and so forth and so on. Those are the givens. They aren't meaningful in their own right. They're just objects. They're people or words or place or whatever. The mind, the seichel, must draw up from that storehouse of experience, which is the female world, only those elements that it needs to go from this step to that step. Any extraneous element will block the process. Is that right? If you're doing mathematics, and you have to go from step one to step two, so then the equation must go from this step to that step, and the only thing that can be allowed into the equation are these numbers, or these symbols. As soon as extraneous symbols start to get mixed in, you can't do the arithmetic. Are you with me? The logic of the arithmetic, the mathematics of it, the abstract mathematics is called seichel. The numbers in the equations are called dimyon. Are you with me? One can't function without the other. You must have a mother and a father. If you put numbers in there without a process, you don't have mathematics. But if you have a process without numbers, without symbols, you can't have mathematics. The process is meaningless. It needs a woman to give it expression. And nothing could be more obvious. But the problem is that the process doesn't want to drive itself. The process of logic will only work if you push it from one step to the next. Whereas the symbols, the numbers, are racing ahead. That's all they want is to function. You with me? Let's describe it. You sit down to think about a problem. This is what happens. You take factor one and factor two and you put them together, and you're about to move to step two when an extraneous association of one of the elements that's in your mind suddenly triggers off another association. Completely irrelevant. Yes? What you're thinking about reminds you of something else, and before you can catch yourself, you're thinking about that thing, and then that thing has a memory attached to it, the memory has a smell, and that takes you some other place, and before you know it, you're in Hong Kong, and you can't remember what you started off thinking about. You ever had that experience? The reason is because the dimyon dimension, the imagination dimension, is so powerful that it runs away with you. But not only is it powerful, it isn't controlled. So the connections it makes have no logic at all. They're the most superficial picture-like or tangible or emotional connections, I think it's obvious. And therefore, that's what happens. Of course, the time when it happens worst is when you least want it to happen. Usually when you're trying to dove in a good Shemona Esrei, that's what happens. You stand up and you say, I'm going to speak to Hashem today better than I ever have. I'm really going to mean this davening. No, they say davening is like, it's music. The instrument is you. The score is the notes, the words in the siddur. That's the score. You take the siddur, you have the beautiful musical score in front of you. It's pure music and poetry, and you're the instrument. Now you sit down to make music with this. You take three steps back, you take three steps forward, and you start. Before you know it, you're in some place where you definitely don't want to be, not while you're davening, and you can't remember where you're holding Shemona Esrei, or you're taking three steps back and you don't even know what you said. That's the way it goes. That's why, by the way, the halacha is when you're davening, if you have intention, what's called kavanah, just for the first brocha, you fulfill your obligation of praying. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that embarrassing? If you're 19 brochas in Shemona Esrei, the Rambam says that if you mean the first one sincerely, you speak to Hashem, and 1/19th of what you say to Him you mean, and the rest you're on a world tour, you fulfilled your obligation of davening. It's a very, very embarrassing state of affairs. But the truth is that if a person can concentrate, if you can think about one thing for 3 minutes without interruption, you're in the Super League. You're in the league of the most self-controlled individuals on earth. One subject without a break, without an extraneous association for 3 minutes, that's intense self-control. And that's the difference between somebody who develops emotionally, mentally, spiritually, and somebody who doesn't. And therefore the exercise should be to try and mean only the first bracha, and the next week work on the second one. And when you can get that right with intense concentration, to mean the third one as well. That's the most intense and powerful meditational training that there could be. Now, the idea, you see, is that the seichel dimension has to give the logical pathway to the dimyon dimension. And the perfect creation of anything in the world, like everything, is a marriage. Only when she gives enough images that are appropriate, and he controls them, appropriately moving them, so she gives the energy, he gives the non-energy rich pathway, and the two of them move towards there. And there are different ways of doing it. A mathematical type of exercise or mind is one in which the overriding power, let's not call it power, the overriding consciousness is the logic pathway. And the images that come in are the most faintest symbols. They can even be abstract symbols that mean very general things, like in mathematics. They don't even have to be definite. They can just be abstractions, like symbols. And that's enough to push the logic ahead. Other forms of energy, like a great artist, for example, an artist functions on the female end of the spectrum. This tremendous energy of the dimyon, which is creating and spraying into the consciousness, tremendously rich images, but with just enough connection, just enough control, they say it's like, let's say, a very small man on a very powerful horse. It's tremendous energy, but he's got just enough control to guide it in one direction. That's what a tremendous flow of artistic creation is. It's a tremendously rich flow of the creative, of the dimyon dimension, the imagination dimension, but it's not haphazard, because there's enough control, very sensitive and subtle marriage, that just keeps the energy flowing in. Of course, this generation has just used the dimyon without any control at all. Not the seichel at all. They take a cat and put paint on its feet and let it run across the canvas, and then they sell that as a great work of art. That's of course a symbol of the breakdown of marriage in this generation. That's why art and culture and so many of its manifestations, as we discussed before, have become disjointed. It is an accurate expression of the emotion of this generation. It's not just a joke or it is actually an expression of the internality of this generation, that there is not a harmonious marriage between man and woman or between the two dimensions of the mind. That's exactly what it is. Let's just look at one more application. Of course, the message that we're supposed to take home, what we've done so far just described, the message you're supposed to take home from this is that with this understanding of how the mind works, at least in that particular dimension, there's many more dimensions above the seichel or other dimensions, male and female, and below the dimyon other dimensions too. We're just picking on one faint sliver, one thin slice of the function of the mind, just to be able to understand that. But the message that a person should take home is that if you want to think logically, if you want to be able to be creative, if you want to be a creative genius or a logical genius, you need a perfect marriage between these two faculties. It doesn't mean that there aren't times when the mind can rest. There are times, but when you're trying to get a problem solved or move from one stage to another, then a person has to have the sharpness of discipline to know that the seichel must grasp the thing as it actually is, without any words at all, and be in perfect control and use only those elements that the female dimension supplies and use her energy so that the two of them go where they're going. Yeah, hard to put into words, but a person who's sensitive to his own thought process will understand it. Let's just say one word about a related subject and then we'll leave it there for this evening. When this thing doesn't work, So then a number of breakdowns are possible. We describe what happens when the female dimension overrides, which is a typical situation. When the female dimension overrides, what happens is, again, there's no logic in the connections. And since it's where the energy is, and it's where the tangible connection to the emotions and the body is, of course, that's why this generation has been overwhelmed by that. That's why there's very little logical thought anymore. That's why the Torah authorities of this and recent generations haven't even put their energies into spiritual, into working in proofs of the spiritual reality, because people aren't thinking. That was done by previous generations. What happens when the male dimension goes wrong? Let's just spend a few minutes trying to understand. It's a fantastic idea to understand. Let's just try and understand. This is the idea of wastage of seed. What happens when that is done? So let's just briefly try and understand this idea. It's a fascinating idea. The best I can do is tell you, share Gemara with you. Gemara describes the following situation. Again, there's no time to go into the details of it, which are fascinating. We have discussed on other occasions some of it. But let's just try and get the general idea. The Gemara says the following thing. I'm going to tell you a story now that the Gemara repeats. But this is a piece of Agadah. Agadah in the Gemara is that part of Talmud that describes the mystical reality. But again, the worst thing in the world is to understand it literally. I mean, it's as literal as possibly could be. But that's not the point. The point is to understand it in that dimension above where the words are. That's an enormous effort, but let's see if we can do it. As we go through it, I'll tell you, as we go through it, let's see if we can try and work out what is the, what you call the Tama Elyon, the higher tune, that the mystics talk about. Let's see if we can do it. So Gemara says the following thing. There was a man called Shlomo, Solomon, King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech. The word means completeness. Shlomo means completeness, the ultimate male level. It also means Moshel, which means the man who was able to put Torah, just make it tangible enough to understand, bring it down from abstraction. You see exactly. That's, by the way, why he married 1,000 women. The reason he had 1,000 wives was because he married the Aleph. Aleph is Aleph. He was a man who was Aleph, very, very, very potent maleness, and needed all the energy of his male expression to be brought out. That's why there were 1,000, I mean, the mystical plane. What happened was this. One day, it says, tragic story, frightening story, very frightening, and all the more frightening when you realize it's you. Right? The mystics say that they're not a description of what happened to him, it's a description of what happened to you, what's happened already to you and me. One day, it says, he became curious about wanting to know what this mystical dimension is and how it's run and how it's controlled. That's called the dimension of the shading. Let's try and understand. Again, you shouldn't talk too much about these things, because certain energy is generated in these worlds when you do. But basically it's like this. There's a world intermediate. You know, there's a mystical axiom that between any two worlds there's a third intermediate world which has qualities of both. The mystics go into great detail that the physical world has something intermediate between physical and plant, and then there's plants. Then there's something intermediate between plant and animal, and then there's animals. Something between animals and man, that happens to be monkeys, by the way. And then there's something intermediate between man and an angelic being, also, which we'll talk about. But there was. Now, the intermediate level between the physical world and the spiritual world, what we call malachim, in English the word angels, again, is almost useless, but the world of what we call angels, whatever that mystical emanation is, whatever it means, there is a set of beings that inhabit a plane that is a little bit of both. They have some physical reality. They multiply, it says. They multiply in the world, unlike angels. But they can't be seen in the normal human physical way. That, in that sense, they live in the mystical plane. They have a little bit of both. Actually, there are some ways. They're very negative creatures, tremendously destructive beings. Try and explain why. And there are certain ways you can trace them. You can do certain things and see their footprints, which I would highly recommend you don't do. But there are certain techniques a person uses can get in touch with these things, maybe in this generation. Not anymore, but they're called shadim. Shade, the word shade in Hebrew is a very amazing word. Let's try and understand a bit more about them and then we'll understand what the word means, why it means that. But these beings, now let's understand, where do they come from? Why are they half human and half non-human? Again, we are not talking literally now, okay? At least we're talking very literally, but we're not talking physically. These creatures are born of a world where man's energy is put in and there's no woman. And therefore, they do come into the world, but not fully. Are you with me? When a man starts the creation of a child, let's talk about it bluntly. When a man starts the creation of a child, and there's no woman to pick it up and give it body, what you have in the world is a being that's a neshama, that's a spiritual energy, it's a human consciousness, but it doesn't have a body to make it tangible and finite, so it hangs around in a world waiting to be concretized, and it's a halfway creature. Where were they born? Shouldn't be hard to work out. It says they were born when Adam Arishon, separated himself from his wife. because of his sin. Because of the sin which involves Chava, I'm not going to go, it's very awkward to speak about here. He decided to separate, and for 130 years it says he lived separate from his wife. And during that time, when a man's energy goes out into the world, and there's no woman, so then what that seed creates is what's called shame. This is the damage of why we are so careful not to waste seed. Again, I'll have to talk about it in detail. I'll have to speak separately some other time. But that's what it is. So there are beings, it's very, again, the mystic says it's because it's a woman in the imagination. Again, I can't go into detail. It is a woman, but it's only a woman in imagination that causes that. Anyway, so now what happened was these beings were created in the world. And these beings float around now in the world. They are beings that are halfway between the physical and spiritual worlds. And they are very destructive because they haven't been brought into their full expression. They have the energy that wants to make them come into the world, and they're trying to find expression, and they can't come in. And it says they cause all the damage in the world. They cause all friction in the world. They cause things to wear out. There are many things that they cause. They are total creatures of the imagination. They are not imaginary. They're not imaginary. But they're very, very real. But they're as unreal as they could be, these creatures. They're formed only by the imagination. The word shade, for example, there are two other times, there are two other applications of that word. One means the breast, and one means when the manna fell from heaven, they didn't know what it was. And it says, Kalashad Hashemin. It was like this. It uses this word. What's the connection? Because the mystics say when the child suckles, it can taste whatever it wants in the milk. It's a function of imagination. And the manna was a food that you tasted, it tasted like whatever you wanted. In other words, anything in Hebrew, that's an indication, these two letters, that they are formed, of course it's two incomplete letters of Hashem's name. Hashem's name, that means the name of limitation, Shin, and then a Dalet, and then a Yud afterwards, the spiritual letter. When that letter's there, the word forms Hashem's name, that means concrete limitation in the world and creation. When you don't complete the word, what you have is this dimension of imagination that hasn't come into being properly, and it's tremendously, very, very dangerous dimension. Today we're insensitive to it, and therefore many of the halachas of taking guard and protection against these things don't apply today, because today we are so damaged that we are below the level, never mind being damaged by Shadim. Today we've already been damaged by the Shadim. Today we live in such an imaginary world, we're so unconnected from reality, they don't even bother with us, the Shadim, anymore. So we don't have to take protection anymore in many ways. Not that we're above it. We're below it. But nevertheless, there were generations sensitive enough to feel it. Now, King Solomon wanted to know about this dimension. He was a man of intense wisdom. He was the man who lived at the borderline of Yeshmael, the ultimate male. And he wanted to have control over the total spectrum of reality. A lot of this should be clear. We don't have time to spell it out. If I want to discuss this evening, it should be clear. So the Gemara says this, that he set out to capture the king of the Shadim. He wanted to capture the king of the Shadim because he was a king. He was the king of reality, of the real world. During Solomon's time, during Shlomo's time, there were no wars. The world was run according to Torah law. It was a world of perfection for 40 years when he ruled. He wanted to capture the king of the Shadim again, again, again. Use your abstraction over here. We're not talking children's stories. The Gemara puts it in a childlike way. Children can also understand. But we're talking here at a very, very deep metaphysical level. So he wanted to capture the king of the Shadim in order to understand. So it says he sent out a task force to capture him. And the king of the Shadim was a being called Ashmedai. So Shlomo managed to capture him. He captured him with a certain chain they put around his neck with Hashem's name, a whole mystical thing. I'm not going to go into the details. And he brought him back in chains. And the Gemara is a fantastic Gemara about this creature of the imagination, what he said as he was brought back in captivity. Amazing. At one point it says he started laughing. They asked him what he was laughing at. They said, look at that man. He's standing on a certain place and he's looking into the distance where he can make his fortune and find treasure. Just under his feet, a few inches under his feet, is a tremendous treasure. And he doesn't know it. He's laughing and laughing about it. And he revealed things like that as they go. I don't understand all these things. Anyway, King Shlomo brought him and he kept him in chains. And while he was in chains, the world was perfect. Because while he was captured, in other words, let's understand what we're saying here. We're not telling fairy tales here. While the dimension of imagination was under control, are you with me? While the dimension, the king, while the dimension of imagination was under control, so the world was perfect, everything was correct. What ruled the world was the essence of reality of Torah. There was no false imaginary things that were floating around. And Shlomo was able to bring the world to that perfection. He was such a giant spiritually that he was able to bring the world to that perfection. He kept him in chains. And the world reached a perfection that never achieved before. One day, the Gemara says,
One day,
Shlomo called in this king in chains, Ashmedai, and he said to him the following thing: tell me how you people operate. I want to understand. I want to know how you creatures function. So he said, sure, take this thing off and I'll show you. So he says, Shlomo took it. And in that instance, it says he swallowed him. According to one opinion, he swallowed him. According to another, he threw him 400 passes. He threw Shlomo 400 passes. 400 passes is like 400 kilometers. Why that distance? The mystics say because the borders of Eretz Israel, the borders of the land of Israel, are 400 passes. Which means that he threw him out of the world of Kedusha. You have to understand, it's very, 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 very deep and beautiful things. He threw him out of the dimension of Kedusha. And Shlomo arrived in a place where he was nobody. And Ashmedai sat on the throne and he started ruling. And he looked exactly like Shlomo. He was an exact replica of the king. Because that's exactly what he is. That's exactly what the Shadim are. There are dimensions of the imagination that are perfect, perfect reflection. I was at a shir where, I'll never forget this, one of the Talmidim said to my Rebbe, can we see them today? So he said to him, yes, look in the mirror. Understand? He wasn't joking. And he ruled. He sat on the throne and he started ruling the country, which means ruling the world. The world was run by Torah. And on the throne, and Shlomo was wandering the streets as a beggar. The Gemara had nothing left except a cloak or a stick. Two opinions. All he had was left was a staff, and another opinion is gundoy, his cloak. And he wandered the streets. Can you imagine? He wandered the streets telling people, you know who I am? I'm the king. And they said, we know all about people like you. Because on the throne was Shlomo HaMelech ruling. But very, very evil. Very evil. As evil as Shlomo was good and great, so was this being ruling the world. It's not a story that's distant from us. They make no mistake. It's not a fairy story that happened once. Unfortunately. Alibi. Unfortunately. The inner world is always ruled by this being. It takes a lifetime of effort to break out at all. But anyway, Ashmedai was ruling the world. According to one opinion in the Gemara, this went on for 40 years. And according to another, it never ended. Never ended. Shlomo never got back to being the king. We Paskan, I think, like the opinion that says that he got back. Melech, Mehenjeet, Melech. He was again a king after 40 years he managed. How did he get back, according to that opinion? Gemara says an incredible thing. Understand carefully. The Gemara says this. The Sanhedrin at the time, the men of the great Sanhedrin, the Torah sages of the time, they got a feeling that something was wrong. They got a feeling with a great Torah insight and sensitive. Although he was an exact replica, and that's how he is. The king of the Shadim, the Yetzer that governs you, the dimension of imagination that lives your life in an unreal fashion, he looks exactly like you. And he does it better than you do because he knows you inside out. He doesn't play games. He knows exactly who you are because he is you. But they still got a feeling that something was wrong. And they wanted to know if this man on the throne was Shlomo or not. And they couldn't find out because he was too exact a replica. So it says they did the only thing possible. How do you find out when you need to know something about a man? How do you know? How do you find out something that's very, very, very deep? There's only one way you ask his wife. Because a woman always knows the depth of her husband. Always, can never be fooled. So they called the women. The Sanhedrin called the wives. Some of the wives, Shlomo's wives, and they said, in private, they said, is he normal? So the women said, no, he's definitely not normal. So they said, why? What is he doing? So the women said like this, he's toveya us when we need her. In other words, he calls us for conjugal rights when we are menstruating. So then they understood. And also, not only that, but one of us that he calls is Bathsheba, his mother. A woman that he calls for his conjugal rights calls Bathsheba his mother. So then they understood exactly who he was. What does it mean? Of course, not hard to work out. We're not going to go into detail, but very, very briefly, the whole force of menstruation in the mystical world is always the opposite of the life energy. The life energy in the world is where a very, very briefly, very briefly, if you want to know what the sin is on the woman's side of reality that we described on the male side a while ago, the sin on the woman's side that generates tremendous negative forces is to have a relationship with a man when she's a nida, when the menstrual forces are there. Because those forces, the mystics say that blood is the part where the nefesh lives. It means is the life energy of the body is connected to the blood, and loss of blood is always a loss of life energy, which is a manifestation of death forces. But loss of life energy from the part of the body that can conceive life is such a potent manifestation of death forces that it's lethal. And that's why we don't allow husband and wife to be together, mystically, that's a mystical explanation, why we don't allow husband and wife to be together, or even have any contact at all, while that phase of... It's because, as we've said many times, the woman is more sensitive spiritually, so she can feel a higher... being on a higher level spiritually. But when she has not got that higher level, then she feels a much lower level. A man is a much more even in this way. And therefore, there's a tremendous manifestation of their forces. And of course, because the world of Shadim, you can work out the rest for yourself. That's of course why we use mikveh. That's why a woman goes to a mikveh before she's with her husband. Because the mikveh is water, which is the formless dimension. The world was created from water. She immerses herself completely in water, special water, pure rainwater. And she emerges again, completely purified again. And that's a woman's greatness. She's able to feel that pull of the negative, and she's able to reach that greatness spiritually. But of course, the negative forces of imagination, they suckle only from the death place. They suckle only from the death forces. They're not interested in the life forces. That's not what they're here for. They suckle, and therefore he needed women. He needed women who only were in the... Your father, the others would have killed him. He lives only from the imaginary, non-life-giving dimension. Again, I can't go into details. I'm sure if you think about it. And that's what happened. And then, of course, that's what happened, and that's how they discovered, who he was, and that's... But all you have to understand over here is that that energy, there's a dimension of imagination in the world, that when it's not connected to the male control dimension, when there isn't a perfect marriage, so then you have one of these two forms of destruction. So let's just sum up what we should get a message out of all this. I mean, we speak about these things here a little bit. Some of these things are not really supposed to be spoken about in too much detail, but here we have many opinions that this generation, we are allowed to study some of these things. We want to bring people closer to Torah nowadays. Therefore, we're allowed to talk about some of these things. But we should remember that to try and study these ideas in abstraction and not make them practical, that's not what we have. That would be exactly the wrong use of this theme that we discussed this evening. Exactly the wrong use of this beautiful and deep, sensitive Torah idea would be to walk out of here and try and retain this in the dimension of imagination. That's exactly what's not supposed to be. A person is supposed to come to a level of marriage. That means to take everything that a person has learned and connect it together with the practical world of Mitzvah Shem and build things that are lasting and relevant.